You are listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Dean Spade. Dean Spade is an organizer, speaker, author, and professor at Seattle University's School of Law. His newest book is Love in a Fucked Up World, How to Build Relationships, Hook Up, and Raise Hell Together. This podcast is supported by the Jan Machowski Foundation.
It's not surprising that friendships and sexual relationships develop between organizers, where passions run high and shared values and goals give a sense of belonging or intimacy. Of course, we're going to hook up with the hot, brilliant people in our movements, those who understand our ideas and want to fight for liberation. As a feminist and a queer, I know how important sexuality can be as a site of transformation, expression, and community building. Sexual and romantic relationships are thrilling and can be meaningful sites of self-discovery, support, and healing. In fact, many people join resistance movements to find like-minded people. It might be obvious to say that sex and other types of connection go hand in hand with resistance work. We find the relationships we've longed for in resistance movements. But the excitement of finding these intense connections doesn't guarantee they will unfold smoothly. Working day to day with others in these movements, I have seen and experienced too often how difficult and destructive relationship conflict between organizers can be. Even people who have dedicated their lives to their principles can end up acting in unprincipled ways, often unconsciously, in relationships. Why is it that we find the courage to boldly confront mainstream societal norms and structures, yet are so often unable to treat romantic partners with care and generosity? Why do we lose our principles when we become insecure, disappointed, or jealous? Why do we act our worst in sexual and romantic relationships? And why do we prioritize romantic connection above other types of relationships like friendship? I've seen again and again how difficult it is for us to align our values with our actions in relationships. I've witnessed firsthand the way our behavior with romantic and sexual partners can explode groups, sabotage projects, and thwart our work. I have deeply questioned my own behavior and used countless tools to make changes and help those I mentor and collaborate with to transform these harmful patterns in themselves. I wrote this book because the stakes are extremely high. I believe we can and must bring our most radical, visionary ideas of liberation into our practices of sex, love, and romance, and to all the relationships in our lives. We need each other now more than ever, and we have to learn to stick together even when emotions run hot. Love in a Fucked Up World doesn't offer a quick fix or 30-day solution. Those don't happen in real life. What it does offer is a practical roadmap for how to navigate some of the most common patterns of relationship conflict and practical tools for managing knee-jerk reactions in situations of high emotion. The book is really for anybody who's political, even just starting out, just beginning to be like, there's something wrong with the systems I live under. I want to be in movements. Our movements are made of relationships. So if you're just getting into our movements, or if you've been here for years and been watching the ways we hurt each other and fall apart relationally, this book is about what are these common patterns. I sometimes have talked about my biography. Of course, everyone knows I'm trans, and I've talked about losing my mom when I was a kid and living with foster parents and stuff here and there where it's been relevant. But this is definitely another level to share more about my own healing process and about some of my own experiences in relationships. It'll be interesting to see what that feels like to be more. I don't think of myself as like extremely private, but I think I just accidentally sort of am, even though I love talking about all this stuff with people who I get to know. So I think a lot of my own journey engaging with therapy and self-help did come from having that traumatic experience of losing my mom when I was a kid. And also before that, my mom was an alcoholic and we were living in poverty. And I just shaped myself in ways that I think are pretty common for a lot of people. I kind of repressed a lot of feelings like grief and loneliness to get by, which I think so many people have to do, and overperformed at school because that was a place where I could get attention from adults. And that ended up being the way that I got out of where I'm from and stuff, is through scholarships and all of that. There's been like a whole lifetime of trying to build back my emotional range, feel what I couldn't feel then, and notice how those coping mechanisms shaped my capacity to be in authentic relationships with others, right? Because when you're repressing a lot of your feelings and doing a lot of overdoing, which was that's just one kind of mechanism that many people also share. It's hard to be truly vulnerable with others. There is so much we can't control that's terrifying and heartbreaking right now, right? So we all are seeing every day the headlines out of Gaza, the headlines about the ecological crisis, the fear of what the next Trump presidency will bring. And we've been living this way for a long, long time, far before the recent election, right? We are also all under enormous pressure, the general global pressure and our specific lives. And we might be hard on on each other, right? We might flake or ghost. We might be bossy to each other. We might get really dug in about a small decision the group needs to make because actually it's our frustration somewhere else that's making us want to control this decision. We might be just not treating ourselves well generally, like I'm not really sleeping or I'm not really eating. Or I went through a period in my life where I was so disordered about my own childhood experiences of poverty and not being poor anymore, but I would give all my money away to the point where I couldn't afford things I needed because I could see the desperation of people in my community, which was just actually true, right? Like I often do know a lot of people who are unhoused or just coming out of prison or really need it. And I could not figure out that boundary of could I have anything if others don't have what they need? There's just so much rough stuff in our functionality. And then it's even if we're friends with someone in the group or we're lovers with someone in the group and there's a disagreement there. I mean, you can just imagine it's like maybe that group is the only place where I'm expecting to feel any belonging. And now it feels like the end of the world because some people went out to dinner without me in the group or made a decision when I wasn't at the meeting or they didn't do the task that I was hoping they would do. These things, they really matter. And so on the one hand, it can be really hard. And on the other hand, this is a beautiful place to do this emotional work in groups. We are injured in groups primarily, like in our families, our schools, and we can heal in groups. Like this is the right place to try out treating each other the way we wish people treated each other, not the way we've been treated in our society. And even noticing, wow, does our group default to some societal norms like making somebody the boss or rushing everybody or being too outcome oriented and not caring about the process or are any of these things creeping? Is there gendered labor stuff happening in this group where women are cleaning up and men aren't? Any of it. This can be a place where we can actually heal together some of these fundamental things that we're each carrying in our own way individually because we all have slightly different coping mechanisms or individual paths, but also that we're as a group reproducing. Are we acting out family roles and I'm being the angry dad or the petulant teenager who has to disrupt everything? And can we just get more aware? When I'm upset, can I know I'm upset? When I'm emotionally activated, can I know? And can I even someday maybe even know more about that? Like, oh, right now in this meeting, I'm imagining Mia as the way that my sister bullied me or something like that. Am I putting someone else in the role? Am I projecting something on them? Or I'm imagining Mia as my savior who's going to be my hero. Like, can I just know? It's not about trying to never feel that way, never have those states come in. But when we know we're having them, we have a little tiny bit more choice. So maybe now I don't need to say the mean thing. Or maybe right now I don't need to ghost. Or I could say to Mia, I'm feeling really avoidant of the group. Can I talk to you about it and get some support? Or I'm feeling some jealousy because I think some people are closer friends than me. Just even knowing it's happening. Because most of us, we're gripped by these emotions and then we just act as if they are reality. And that's when we often act outside our values and lose relationships or connections that we long for. And so that's a lot of what I think is the skill set that I wish for us all to have. And even could we get to the place where we can say it to each other, where you could know me well enough to be like, Dean, you seem really stirred up right now and it's kind of rushing the meeting, but what's it feel like? How's it going? You know, something like that. Obviously we need a certain level of trust to talk to each other about things we're noticing in each other, but what if we could build friendships and connections where you could get direct feedback? Someone could be like, you know, sounds kind of vengeful the way you're talking about your ex and actually they're a person in our community. I really hear that you're hurting. I really want to hold you in that. And also I want us to stay aligned with our values to not take revenge on people. Could we get enough skills and enough trust and compassion to even support each other to live our values? That's something I long for all of us. I'm hoping that this last election was truly the death knell of liberalism and the Democratic Party for a lot more people. I mean, they're obviously who they've always been, but I mean, it was so naked that liberalism is a project about remaining invested in the current genocidal, ecocidal systems and that it has nothing to offer us. They have nothing to offer us. They are lined up with immigration enforcement. They don't give a fuck about queer and trans people or reproductive justice. They're 100% behind these horrible wars, including the genocide in Gaza. I just hope we can all truly turn away from that towards what is needed because it really takes away a lot of people's energy. This is a hard moment and I'm not interested in any false hope. I'm interested in us being like, wow, it's a really hard moment. Okay, we are motivated to get it together with each other and be really bold and brave and really caring towards each other and really discerning about what is a waste of time in terms of trying to convince elites to rescue us. I feel like this moment is clarifying, hopefully mobilizing. Certainly a lot of people are filled with a lot of anxiety. I feel like one of the best solutions to that fear is to join with others. Get out of it being a single experience with just me and my phone and the doom scrolling and get towards being with others, feeling the grief and the fear and choosing to do something pragmatic right away. How can we enjoy some of the ways that those things are pleasurable without actually signing up for the most extreme forms of isolation and controlling others and being controlled and believing my safety is wedded to being able to control others? And these are the downsides of the romance myth that are very vibrantly alive across our society, including in feminist and queer and trans communities. It's everywhere. Yeah, I love that idea. I mean, it's so rich, that classic feminist slogan, the personal is political. I think that when second wave feminists were saying that, part of what they were saying is the supposed liberation movements they were in that would just be like, yeah, don't talk about women's issues, what happens in the bedroom or who does the dishes or who changes the diapers, that's your personal problem. And people were like, actually, no, this is a political condition. condition where women are forced to do all the reproductive labor, and they politicized these areas. And second wave feminists really brought attention to domestic and interpersonal violence and rape and said, we've been told this doesn't matter or isn't important or is our personal issue. And actually, this is a huge political condition of the entire society. We live in a rape culture. So they said, let's bring the spotlight to these areas that have been considered private or behind the fence. And that, to me, still exists, where people are like, oh, well, dating is not a serious thing to talk about, or sex. I think in queer culture, it's a bit different. But in a lot of our lives, the real political issues are just like, let's talk about the Affordable Care Act and let's talk about fracking. But let's not talk about the fact that in our meetings, people are relating with each other and people are being sexually unethical in our movements and it's causing disruption or harm. Or also that we experience very significant suffering in our lives in these relationships, and that it matters, and that it's related to huge political systems that keep us all in our places by scripting very narrow roles for us that are gendered and racialized and all that stuff. A script like the romance myth is insidious. It's in people's heads in many unpredictable and unexpected ways. It's propaganda, right? And we're told it's natural. That's the other thing. We're told things that are personal are natural. Like, I just want that. It's like, why do you want that? You know, the questions that our radical movements let us ask is, where did that desire come from? Is that actually mine? Or did I imbibe that? And people know this about some levels of consumption. Like, why do you think you want an SUV? Or why do you think you want a vacation in Hawaii or whatever? Like, oh, that's colonialism and capitalism are producing that for you and telling you what to want and making you part of the war machine that colonizes Hawaii, et cetera. I think when it comes to the really intimate, we're sometimes like, no, it's just natural that I'm jealous, or it's just natural and inevitable that when I meet someone, I want to have a baby with them or whatever. I just love them, like, well, could we take it apart a little? Could we be like, actually, these are shared cultural fantasies that are about our truly human needs to have belonging and safety and connection and creativity, but they don't need to play out this way. And actually, countercultures have for a long time played with this, right? There's nothing new about countercultures thinking about free love and thinking about sexuality differently and thinking about queerness and thinking about child rearing differently, right? And so can we not relegate those questions, which determine so much of our lives and so much of our emotional conditions and the lives of the groups that we're trying to form? Can we not relegate them? A lot of people don't want the self-help literature. There's a kind of like a, that's so neoliberal, that's so light, it's not serious. There's something in there that's, I think, a bit sexist, you know? It's like women are supposed to be concerned about the emotional lives of families and people, and women are supposed to keep sex together and make everything work, and the really serious stuff will happen in the boardroom and in the serious activist meeting and in the electoral realm. And that's not what we believe as feminists and just as people who care about liberation. We actually think it's all connected. And so I think for me, the personal is political just remains an utterly relevant and radical statement. And it is interesting for me to move from the way I've been seen with the other books that I have. I'm very serious. That's been my political realm, is very serious, and it is very serious. And I feel this for me is equally serious. This is life and death. People I know lose their lives, go to prison because of stuff that happens in their love relationships. It's so momentous. And so many groups that we really needed to exist, that were doing something vital, that were saving lives, ended because people had a bad breakup and forced each other to take sides, or because somebody was sexually exploiting people in the group. Like, this is really, really, really dire. And it's an anti-sex society and a sexist society that pushes it back and says it's not serious and it's not important. I mean, I feel like life is really short. I don't work on anything that I don't think is absolutely necessary to helping our movements thrive. And this, to me, became a 9-year project because I thought it was that important. Also, just to go back to this question, are humans rational beings? We are rationalizing beings, you know? And I think I see this a lot in our political movements. Like, I feel jealous of you in our activist group, or I feel irritated by you, and I come up with a political rationalization for why you're not good. I'm really scared about how we weaponize our politics to try to justify our strong emotions in our movement. It's really dangerous and really common. So I think that's something for us all to look for too. When I'm feeling a strong political difference with someone and I'm feeling really stirred up, is it just the political difference is likely to be there too, but is there also any emotional work I need to do? Or am I trying to put it all on the political difference or the identity difference, things like that? For me, really the places where I learned this stuff, I would say where I learned everything in so many ways, is women of color feminism. So much of my work has come from the lessons in the anti violence movement in the United States against policing and criminalization that really generated this kind of abolitionism we have now, that really was born in those feminist spaces that were all led by women of color who were identifying the problems with the white anti-violence movement focusing on policing and punishment, how that was never going to work for women of color and immigrant women and women with disabilities, and the ways that queer and trans people were central to those processes. So that thinking, that space, is a space where people are like, okay, wow, there's a lot of relational problems in our movements and in our communities. How do we solve them? Not pretending that the police can solve them, since of course please make everything worse and don't solve anything. And so those people have been just trying to work out relational problems in communities through frames like transformative justice for decades and decades. And I've been studying with those people and collaborating with those people. And that's just a lot of deep wisdom about what relationships really are, as opposed to what the fantasy of them is, and how to relate to each other in ways that let us long-term support each other. You know, like being in the prison abolition movement, spending years and years and years, and I have decades-long relationships with people who are in prison. That's a really complicated relationship. There's a lot of power dynamics. There's a lot of harm happening. Learning by being in these relational settings where we are dedicated to love and care and compassion against very difficult odds, I think, has deeply informed my thinking in here. But some of the people whose writing and activism have been immensely influential, people like Miriam Kaba, Adrienne Marie Brown, Andrea Ritchie, Mimi Kim, Lauren Berlant, I mean, I could go on, Shira Hassan, people who have been deep inside harm reduction movements or anti-violence work, or just thinking about how the realm of feeling and relating underlies the big systems of violence that we're all fighting, and actually bringing their work down to those levels to solve things instead of passing useless legislation that says cops shouldn't do certain things to us, which doesn't actually ever work, or who've really just been like, okay, the elite solutions don't work. This is all actually taking place in community and relationships. And how do we do that? How do we solve conflict? How do we stop violence really up close and personal? That to me is where the most wisdom is about all of our liberation, honestly, because it all happens at the interpersonal level. The other levels are just made of the interpersonal level over and over and over again. You know, what we're practicing with each other produces the world. And so just trying to imagine somebody from on high telling everyone to stop acting that way.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, subscribe today. Thank you for listening.